We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone.
How's it going?
Hello, everyone. Wow, how do you know how many people are watching? Oh, wow, we've got four people watching already. That's crazy.
There you go.
Cool.
Well, Richie, why don't you introduce our guest and then bring us on? I'm going to mute my microphone so I can check our live audio. But
All right.
Go ahead and do that.
All right. Well, today we have a fellow archaeologist, Jenny Hildebrandt. And she's going to talk about what she's doing now that she might not be doing field archaeology.
Yes.
Yay. Because I feel like a lot of us want to do something that isn't field archaeology. I mean, I know I do at some point, hopefully. Knock on wood, even though this isn't real wood.
I mean, I'm doing both right now too. Probably my, 90% of my finances are coming in from a job that's not, has anything to do with archaeology, not even remotely.
Yeah.
So, it's the side hustle that sometimes becomes the front hustle. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to keep archaeology as like a hobby, check in every once in a while. If you can get on something or do something, if it fits your schedule, there's nothing wrong with that. So.
Yeah. I definitely have it as a career to fall back on. Right. And it's because you're trying to do something different and add on to your skills and knowledge in archaeology doesn't mean that you're like no longer an archaeologist. You're still in archaeology. You're just, branching out and doing other things and
sure.
And
it's interesting. Every time I work a different job and I tell them that I'm an archaeologist, the response I get is, what the hell are you doing here? And I'm like, I don't know, I'm working.
Nice. Well, so the show is called Eucarless Archaeology, which means we don't talk about anything related to archaeology.
Yay.
Which is great. so we should preface this to anybody watching a recording, because every recording I do these days, I'm like, here's what the date is, because just in case the world is changing so quickly and so rapidly, I want people to know where we're at and what we're doing. So it is May 24th, Memorial Day weekend, actually, a Sunday. Yeah. And I was just telling these two before the show, we went out yesterday, we went out today. We're not doing anything Memorial Day weekendy. It's just normal things. It just happens to be the weekend. In fact, unlike people who have a boat, I went out and got my boat from California and brought it back over to Nevada last weekend. And we still don't have it out. Like, Lake Tahoe is a shit show on Memorial Day weekend, and they opened all the boat ramps on Friday. And so we're not going to take it up there, but we did spend half the day yesterday cleaning it. It's been sitting in the Delta in San Francisco for 8 months, and it's just got this green film on the bottom of it. So, you don't get that in Lake Tahoe because it's nice and clean up there.
Yeah.
So we spent a bunch of time cleaning it, getting ready, buffing it out, and we're not taking it out this weekend, but it's a nice thing about the jobs that we have. We can pretty much go out anytime we want and just kind of rearrange the schedule. So we can go out midweek and I can just move my clients around and talk to them some other time. That's one thing I like about the flexibility of remote working, basically. Yeah. So.
I thought you were talking about archaeology, because I felt like when I was, in the field, I always feel like it's like one of those things you're not supposed to be able to ask. Everyone says you can ask for time off, but everyone always gets mad when you ask for time off.
See, the thing is, unless you have a permanent salaried job, which, let's be honest, most people don't. You don't need to ask for time off. Just don't take the next project right away. Take a few weeks off if you want to, and then come back to it.
Well, and the amount of overtime that you occur while you're doing field work too, sometimes you have enough time off saved up because you've done so much field work at, 12, 14 hour days, 10 days in a row. I mean, you've got plenty of vacation time saved up So that allows you to still be able to do that.
Oh, unless... Yeah,
and you have to... Just, I want to comment on that because you have to be careful with that too, because some of these companies, they end up with, in certain time frames, they end up with like back-to-back-to-back things and never enough people to do them. And so then you end up feeling almost guilty asking for time off sometimes. Like, for example, when I was laid off, well, let's say when I was fired from the company that you were recently working for, Jenny, probably about 8 years ago, when I left that job, I actually, my wife quit the day that they let me go. And between the two of us, we got about $11,000 in comp time in checks sent to us. I think mine was like 7,000 and I think hers was 4,000 or something like that. And I mean, it was a nice little severance package, but it made me think, Jesus, I should have taken some time off the time that I've been here.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was nice to have, but I wish the corporate culture almost forced people into time off a little more than they do. They'll work you to the bone if you let them, you know, not this company, but any company really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a common thing.
Well, but your mental health and your physical health is just as important. When you're working, you know, when you get on these long projects and you're doing field work and you're doing, you know, like I said, 12, 13, 14 hour days.
Mm. Yeah.
Sometimes 11 days on, 2 days off, if you're staff, or if you're doing 8 on, 6 off, either way, you're doing long, you know, stretches of field work. You really do have to take time, and you have to take time for your mental health, and you have to take breaks. You have to take some mental days. Very important.
Yeah, you know what's interesting?
Go ahead, Richie.
I was going to say, I feel like a lot of people out there might not know what comp time is, especially if they're students or people who are new to the industry.
Yeah. Well, a lot of companies, I mean, some companies don't do it, right?
Yeah.
But it depends on your level. Yeah, you're right. Sometimes they don't. If you're salaried in some states, they don't have to pay you for work over 40 hours. And in fact, a lot of salaried positions, they even make you sign an offer letter or a hire letter that says, you're expected to work 45 hours a week. I've seen 45 is a pretty common thing for salary positions. And then I would almost prefer you don't get paid for the over 45, because if you do it right and your company is cool with it, like sometimes you do need to put in a 15-hour day, right? But then you can put on a 4-hour day the next day and they shouldn't really say anything, because it all evens out. You know, it should be, if you're salaried, it should be more task-based work than hourly-based work, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
You should just be able to take time off when you have fewer tasks to do. Like the job I'm doing now for this company out of Australia, there are some times when I'm putting in 60 hours a week for this company, and there are some times when I have a lighter client load, just because it's based on the sales cycle. Some clients are quicker than others to get done. And then when I have a lack of clients and maybe just one or two, before they hand me two or three more, I might have some lighter weeks. But I'll tell you what, it's made up for by the weeks that I was slamming it, you know, and trying to get this done. And I think that's where salary is. But comp time, I think, is, it's great. But again, it's a little bit evil, because it makes it so you're making this extra money. Anything over 40 hours is typically comp time. It's at your regular rate. It's not even time and a half typically. And it's like banking vacation almost. Because typically with comp time, I mean, a lot of companies, they don't even give you vacation and sick time if you're getting comp time, because that is your time at the bank, and you just use that. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it encourages people to take time off.
Yeah,
which is why I'm a little bit iffy on it. But it was a good severance package, like I said.
You know, it's interesting. How did you feel about going out in the field, Jenny? Like, you know, during this whole time thing? Because I was like a little nervous.
Pandemic. I thought it was really interesting because, you know, you come from a bigger city or from Reno, and you see people wearing masks, and you see people you know, acknowledging the 6 feet social distancing, and that's a fairly common behavior that people are doing. And then you go out to these remote towns in Nevada, and it's a completely different community mindset and approach to this.
Yeah.
But yeah, when we were out working, you know, out at that location, it was weird that, you know, I mean, before we went onto the job site, we got, you know, the gun with your forehead for your temperature.
Yeah.
We got that, and we would sign a form asking if you've been exposed to anyone with COVID, if you've had any symptoms. And then you just say, no. And then you sign your name, you date it, you turn it in. But yeah, nobody wore masks. Nobody did the 6 feet social distancing, and you would have a safety meeting with, like, you know, 30, 40 construction guys talking about safety for the day. And it's like, all right, everyone huddle up. We're going to talk about safety. So it was just I was a little surprised by, you know what I mean? But it's a difference between, like, when you're in a rural setting and true, nobody wears a mask to the grocery store or the gas station. And then you feel weird when you wear a mask because,
oh my God, yes,
old men give you a very wonderful and sweet explanation as to why you don't need a mask. Yeah, you know, it's just going to different places. It's just a little weird, not gonna lie.
Wait, when I was at that grocery store, I was actually tempted to stock up on all the toilet paper when I saw that the whole aisle was still full.
Yeah, no, they were not as concerned as some places.
No.
Yeah. And they were like, oh, well, it's not out here. It's only in places like Reno and Vegas. And I had just driven across the state of Nevada 5.5 hours and showed up from Reno and went to the grocery store. And I'm like, well, I came from Reno, so.
And the crazy part is that, you know, they've got, like, the main focal point of those towns is the gas station. If there's any place that they're going to get it, it's from there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's great that archaeology and CRM in general is considered essential, and a lot of people have been able to keep their jobs through this whole experience.
True.
I think it's great that archaeology, like, at whatever level you're at a company, you can work from home. I mean, unless you're doing, like, GIS work, it's a little harder.
True.
But you can write reports, you can call people, you can do Zoom meetings and stuff from home. And it's cool to see that fieldwork is still doable. I don't know if some companies are having problems with finding hotels.
Oh,
in places.
I didn't think about that. Work. Yeah, I didn't think about that, huh? Because I haven't had any trouble yet.
Businesses open, right? In order to go do the field work.
True.
Man,
makes me think. You know, I should get that camper out of storage and start using it. You never know.
Is that the one that goes on the back of the truck, or you?
Oh well, I have a little trailer that I can haul around. But I've never used it yet, at least in the field.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a small project that I do every year up near Elko at the Jarrett Canyon mine, just an hour north of there.
Yeah.
And it's usually just a 1 day thing. It's like twice as much work as it used to be because I'm doing kind of BLM and Forest Service stuff at the same time on the same day. So it is kind of a full day. Which means get up there the day before, because we usually start right at first light, because there's like 8 different archaeology sites I got to visit, and they're spread all over this mine. I mean, Richie's been to the four that I have done every year. Now we're adding on, like, 4 new ones every year, and it's just a lot of traveling. So, but anyway, that place is it's about an hour north of Elko.
Yeah.
And my wife's coming out there with me to assist on a Friday. And because it's kind of a weekend that we're doing this, there's a reservoir called the Wild Horse Reservoir about 20 minutes north of that of that mine. So we're actually going to drag the boat all the way out there. And that Wild Horse Reservoir at the campground has a boat launch and pull through spots. So you can have your boat, your trailer, whatever you're going to have, plus a tent. And they've got bathrooms and it's nice. And as a veteran, since it's a state campground, I can stay there for free. So that's nice. It's only like $10 a night. I can still stay there for free. You know, what the heck. But I like it. It's going to be better than staying in Elko, I think, because you are tempted when you're doing field work, especially. Like here, we were just talking about it when we were out at this RV show this morning. How many people were out at the Legends Outlet Mall here in Sparks? I mean, there was 100 people in line at Shields. Nobody was distanced at all, except for the normal, you know, family grouping distancing. And maybe 1% of them had masks on. There was even a line in front of Old Navy. Like, what's so important that you got to stand in line at Old Navy to get in and spend $6 on a pair of pants? I mean, seriously, get them online. But I'm going to like for the weekend not staying in Elko, because you're just tempted to go out. You're tempted to go, you know, get food.
A lot of places are open there too. I had to go buy a long sleeve shirt. So I went to that Cal Ranch store.
Oh yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was packed. It was packed. There was people in line buying guns. It's Elko. I was surprised. There was a lot of people there.
Yeah. Well, like not being in Elko and just staying north of there. And even if we can't, for some reason, put the boat in the water, even if that falls through, we'll just have our tent and stuff, and we'll spend only 3 nights there and come home Sunday just to have the weekend. So,
it's interesting. The mining store in Elko, supposedly they were only letting people, they weren't letting people into the front door or something like that. They had some pretty serious measures there. And
the mine store downtown?
Yeah.
I love that.
Carlin Trend. That place is cool.
Yeah.
It used to be across the street from the Stray Dog, that place.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I think it still is.
Yeah.
And then, who was it? The Wells Fargo, when I went there, they were only letting one person in the store at the time, and they were spraying you down, make sure, that, with hand sanitizer, which I appreciated, even though I was using the drive-thru.
Right.
So hopefully they're taking, slightly seriously-ish.
Yeah. Well, Jenny, and feel free to, we'll scrub this, but if you don't want to, but I'm curious because we do talk a lot of stuff on this live stream that has nothing to do with archaeology, because Richie's point was, well, kind of all has to do with the field of being an archaeologist, like as a field archaeologist, as a CRM archaeologist, we're always doing other stuff, and sometimes we come back, sometimes we don't. So what are you doing right now? What is your focus that you're getting into?
Oh, so right now, I guess I'll preface it with this. So, my specialty in archaeology was historic archaeology, focusing on mining history. So I've done a lot of mining history stuff. And I've always been interested in jewelry and antique jewelry. And I've kind of, I was always wanting to get into the jewelry business. So I kind of had an opening in life where I thought, why not? So I ended up getting a job at a local jewelry store here in Reno called BBW Jewelers. I'll do a shout
out. What's the name?
Huh?
What's the name again? Let me look it up.
BBW Jewelers.
There they are. Okay. All right. Keep going.
Yeah. So I'm going to school right now. I'm taking online classes at the Gemological Institute of America. So I'm going to become a certified gemologist and do a lot of appraisals, like antique appraisals, for insurance purposes. So I do a lot of, it's kind of weird because it overlaps in a lot of ways, and doing historic archaeology and doing jewelry. Like I went from, counting and measuring and describing flakes to counting, measuring and describing and sorting diamonds.
That sounds more fun.
Calipers. So I take calipers and I measure all these loose diamonds and I sort them into different bags. And so, it's pretty cool. It's pretty similar. I kind of want to find a way, especially doing gemology. It kind of overlaps a little bit with mining history and understanding the markets and understanding how gems are mined in the world. Looking at more of like the family heirlooms and the tradition and like the oral histories of jewelry and how important. It's the same thing within archaeology. We have material objects that we give meaning to. And that's what we study as archaeologists. So jewelry in that sense is just another area of another subfield of artifacts, is the way I look at it. How people deal with jewelry and pass it on to their family members. I just kind of want to do more of like jewelry history and appraisals. Yeah. And there's also a career field that's new that's really exciting if you want to look it up. It's called archaeogemology.
Oh, really?
Nice.
Yes. Yeah. It's so cool. So it started in, there's this woman named Dr. Lule, L-U-L-E. And I don't really know how to pronounce it. I think that's how you pronounce it. But she kind of started this career field called archaeogemology about 3 years ago. So it's really new. It's only currently done in Europe and more of Eastern Europe. So I don't really know. I haven't been able to find anyone on the internet that even does it in the United States. But basically, she is a mineralogist and a gemologist, and she subcontracts out to archaeologists. So she has basically a company that gets hired on by archaeologists to study any gems or any jewelry that they find within excavations or on their sites. And she will find the location of, you know, kind of like sourcing obsidian. You find out, you know, where was the source? Where did it come from? What year was it mined? So it's kind of doing more of like a historical detective work on jewelry found in archaeology. Plus, there's also archaeology of jewelry, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that you can do with it. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
You know, I just heard through the grapevine that you were working at a jewelry store. That's how that distills down into you're working at a jewelry store.
Yeah. Doing
like appraisals and stuff, right? Yeah. But that is actually super cool. And it sounds like you need to contact her and you guys can co-host the world's first archaeogemology podcast together on the Archaeology Podcast Network. So
or do a lot of papers.
We'll call it Flakes to Diamonds.
Flakes to Diamonds. Well, I'm giving a presentation on July 1st at the Reno Gem Society, and I'm going to be talking about archaeology and historic mining and archaeogemology and kind of how it all overlaps and what I've been doing in the past and what my goals are and where I'm planning on merging it all. Cool. So I am doing that. So I was going to email her for that. And I've been trying to find some sources online about archaeogemology because it's so new, and because there's technically only one company right now that does it in Europe. There's not much out there on it.
Yeah. Is it Dr. Lully?
L-U-L-E.
Ah, I'm looking at her website right now.
I believe she's out of Turkey.
Oh, really?
Ah. But yeah, if you Google archaeogemology, it's a company. The company has, like, it talks about, you know, the applications and what it is and how it came about.
Cool.
Yeah,
I'm looking at the website right now. Neat.
Yeah, so that's kind of a way to still kind of hold on to archaeology and do it, but also kind of transition into something else.
I mean, I love to have
my own company doing appraisal work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Southern California, I know of archaeologists who do nothing but specialize in cataloging and looking through historic artifacts. Instead of like going out, they just have people send stuff to them.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they still consider themselves an archaeologist.
Yeah.
I mean, this one person I'm thinking of is the most archaeologist I've ever met, but I'm not going to mention his name.
Well, and that's another thing, too. So I was laid off from the jewelry store because of the coronavirus, because we had shut down following the governor's shutdown policy. So anyways, that's how I, a couple weeks ago, ended up going back out in the field. So, I mean, it's kind of great. Archaeology came through when I was laid off, and I thought, well, I can go do field work for a couple weeks and still do my online classes for GIA. And yeah, so just because you leave it doesn't necessarily mean you 100% leave it. You can still visit it every now and then.
Well, that's the way I looked at it when I was at the bookstore. you know, I just looked at it as like something, it is a hobby.
Well, it sounds like you're using that, you're combining the two experiences, the new one you're learning now and then your archaeological experience.
And
you know, really thinking about bringing those two together, which is, I think, something not enough people do. You know, they get into CRM archaeology and then they get burned out on just doing field work and stuff and not really focusing on anything and not really looking at how they can take that skill set and maybe meld it with something else they're interested in and then almost invent a new field even. I mean, you said this is relatively new. People have probably been looking at, you know, antique or historic gems and things like that through time because we have stuff from thousands of years ago. However, making a specific study about that and really getting into it, I mean, that's brand new, like you said, and that's super cool. You know,
well, and if you have, say you have a lot of jewelry, you know, in Egyptian times or Roman times on a lot of those archaeological sites, you can learn a lot about the trade networks and socioeconomic status and the hierarchy of how the culture was set up. Like a lot of the concepts that archaeology, the archaeologists use, you can apply that to sourcing gems and sourcing jewelry.
Do you think there's a, I'm sure with jewelry settings, you know, those are probably definitely cultural. You know, people set gemstones and polished stones and things like that into different settings through time. But I'm wondering about, like, diamonds have always had like specific cuts to them. I wonder if you can really trace that back to, you know, if you see this cut 1,000 years ago on a diamond, it, you know, it belongs to this kind of culture. Or if people just figured out early on how to make diamonds look really good. It hasn't changed much.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the same thing with can technology, right? You can look at a can and say, it was made this way. So based on the technology, it's this old. It's the same thing with specific cuts of diamonds and gems. Yeah.
Right.
You know, because the technologies change. So you can kind of do things that way.
And the styles change.
Yeah.
People's taste.
But there's also, I want to give a shout out to one of my favorite jewelers because she used to be an archaeologist. It's the same
company, really?
Right. Yeah. So there's a jeweler out of California who makes, well, Let me step back. So she was an archaeologist and did a lot of work in Peru, I believe, and then was working at the Met and was working in like textiles or jewelry or whatever. So anyway, she was curious about the stuff that she was curating and then ended up taking some like historic goldsmithing classes. And now she makes jewelry based on like Byzantine, Egyptian, Roman styles, but she will make them using the old ways, the old technique of like, so you can see with like hoses and she'll like blow the gold and her stuff's really great. So it has a really heavy like archaeological influence on the jewelry that she makes.
Cool. What's her name?
Her name's Lauren Nicole. And her stuff is incredible. Yeah. So it's very like Egyptian. She's got a couple different lines that focus on different historic eras. But so you do see that quite a bit too, where you can have a jeweler and their jewelry is heavily influenced with them being an archaeologist. I wanted to send a shout out to her because I really like how she started out as an archaeologist and became a jeweler and has used her knowledge and her love of history and kind of like translated that into the art that she makes.
Yeah, that's kind of like, God, I always forget the name of the brewery, but the brewery who makes those like crazy, interesting beers that they
from the stuff that they find in the pots. Yeah, that's, I know you're talking about. It's one of my favorite beers.
Oh my God. I've only tried Midas Touch and that stuff goes flat so quickly.
Oh, that's what I was thinking of. Is it not Midas Touch?
Yeah, but that's one of the beers, but the brewery behind it, I forget their name. Interesting.
Well, hey, I was going to mention too, because Richie actually stopped by last night. We had some of his mail after he's done with his field work and we sat and talked for a bit. He was mentioning the appraisal thing and my wife was there and she's got, my family doesn't hand down anything except for debt. So I have nothing, but you know, that's how they are. But her family, she has especially on her mom's side. I mean, they have a tradition of, you know, handing things down from time to time. And so my wife's got Well, first off, she's got an engagement ring. The engagement ring I bought her before we got married, that was like a 1930s Art Deco style diamond ring.
Oh,
like
I love Art Deco.
Yeah. And then she's got, I think, like four other rings that were handed down from, you know, great aunts, grandparents, whoever. And they're all from probably the early 1900s or earlier. And they've never been appraised. And we've never had them on our insurance. And I was like, man, if you need some like student pieces to appraise your business,
yeah,
here, we'll,
yeah, absolutely.
Maybe you take a look at them.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Everyone has, well, not everyone, but the majority of people yeah. have family heirlooms or jewelry that they inherited from grandma or an aunt yeah. or whatever.
Right.
It's always a good idea to get jewelry appraised and yeah. put it on your insurance, because ooh. You can have a lot more value than you think you have. I mean, mm-hmm. you could just be like, oh, it's just, you know, that's not worth that much. But you never know. Well, so it's you, definitely get yourself appraised.
Have you learned anything yet about how often you should get it appraised? Because I'm sure the value changes through the years. You know, if you had it appraised 20 years ago, it might be worth something yeah. different now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because the price of gold changes or platinum. Yeah. You know, you do have that market influence. I would say if it's been 20 years, I would recommend getting it reappraised.
Oh.
Sometimes when you get a new insurance plan or a new policy,
mm-hmm.
you sometimes need to get a new appraisal with that.
Yeah.
But it's always yeah. good. You know, it's just like anything you have that could be worth value. It's always good to see what it's worth.
Yeah. Well, it's good to, like you said, put it on the insurance, because you... we have a house here, and if our house burns down, we can say we had $50,000 worth of diamond rings in the house, but they're not just going to write us a check for that.
Yeah. proof?
So this is interesting, because this is where it's kind of like archaeology.
Yeah.
When you have you have all your jewelry, and it's basically like a collection, your collection of jewelry, and you need to inventory yeah. your jewelry. You need to document it.
Yeah.
Not necessarily provenience it. But for insurance purposes too, a lot of times if you take photos of the jewelry on you, like say mm-hmm. you're appraising your ring and you take a photo of it on your hand, you have a better chance of getting all of the money back and then some, because it's proof that you owned it. Because if you say, oh, I had X, Y, and Z, I had all these things, you can't really
yeah.
prove it. But if you have an Excel, say you have an Excel database of all the jewelry
yeah.
you own, what it is, if there's any like trademarks on it or styles or whatever, describe it, whatnot, photo it. So yeah, it's kind of like you're doing a whole inventory of your jewelry. So that just helps too. Like say your house burns down, that'll help.
Yeah. Wow. That is a good idea actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Plus, it almost sounds like something you'd do, you know, when you were first describing that, it made me think about kidnapping someone. You and I probably shouldn't say that.
That made you think of kidnapping someone?
Yeah, because, you know, you always like throw down like a newspaper or something, you know, if you ever watched those movies, to prove that, you know, that you had them on this date or something.
Oh, like a today's date newspaper. Yeah, when you're taking a picture with your ring. I was thinking actually including a picture of a newspaper with a date on it. With the picture for the insurance. I think that's what Richie's talking about, rather than actually kidnapping other human beings.
I know. I've been watching too much on Hulu lately.
So Richie, what is in that old travel trailer of yours? Who do you keep in there?
Nothing. So far, it's empty, aside from a stove and an ice box and a sink that isn't hooked up to anything.
Oh, man.
Nice.
I know. It was one of those things where it's, you know, I bought it because of an archaeology job, and then I haven't been using it because I've been too busy. And now I was thinking I'd wanted to go camping, you know, instead of mm-hmm. staying in motels. So now I'm going to get it out of the storage.
Right. Right.
You know, it's a long story, but there used to be, in fact, I think there's still an RV storage place in Bishop. I used to drive by that all the time, and it was just parked out front. And so suddenly I stopped, and then someone came outside, and then suddenly the next thing I knew, I had a camper that I didn't know what to do with.
All right, then.
I know.
So Yeah, I'm liking the whole gem thing. I'm glad you're giving a presentation. You probably don't have it done yet because we are putting on a virtual conference on May 30th, which is a week from yesterday.
Yeah, I saw that. That's cool.
So I'm going to put the link in there just in case someone comes back and watches this. Yeah, I'll drop the link right in the chat here. But yeah, it's going to be good. It's a little bit of a, I'll talk about that for a second since I brought it up. I didn't mean to talk about it, but it really is a dry run to test out this new basically virtual conferencing platform that we found called Crowdcast. And we need to make sure it's going to work. We've got, I don't know, a handful of people signed up right now. We've got a keynote speaker. We've got, I think, 5 or 6 presenters right now. We were hoping for 9, but you know, we didn't really widely publicize the fact that we were looking for presenters. We were just kind of trying to hit, you know, a few people that we knew because we didn't want a flood of random presentations because we are only taking about 9 of them. We just wanted to kind of hit a few people and say, hey, if you happen to have something you didn't present this year, but you have ready to go, let's do this. But the idea is that it's going to be, it'll definitely be free and free to present, free to attend. And this particular one, the presentations will end up on the Archaeology Podcast Network YouTube channel. It's all said and done. So it's got to be stuff that you're willing to, let out to the general public. But this is in advance of a much larger conference that we're hoping to have hundreds of presenters at, thousands of attendees, and still be totally free because it doesn't actually cost that much money to use this software and put that on. We need volunteers to manage the concurrent rooms, and then we'll take all the videos of the presentations and we're going to put those behind a paywall, but it's going to be a cheap paywall. It's like $30 for a virtual ticket if you want to go view all the presentations. I know. And you know, I'm hoping to, I mean, obviously this is spurred on by coronavirus, but it's also a little bit in response to the mess at the SAAs last year. The incident with that Alaskan professor, and you know, people were so pissed off right after that. In fact, I'm part of a Slack team and I was part of the Facebook group and all the stuff that was set up to put on an alternate conference to the SAAs. Of course that all failed miserably, and I'm kind of glad it did, because if they'd put a bunch of effort into it, it would have failed anyway because of the coronavirus. We didn't know that was coming, but I'm hoping that we keep this thing going for other reasons, because the reasons we all go to conferences are kind of changing, and it's not necessarily to present your work. It is for the presenters sometimes, but everyone else goes to meet people and network.
Network.
Yeah.
You know?
Be your friends. Have fun. Yeah.
Exactly. And I would rather have
good ideas.
I would rather have events that are put on almost more with that focus and less upon the focus of actual presenting, and then use things like the conference we're going to put on, because I want to do it probably 3 times a year forever, as long as we can.
Yeah.
Wow.
So people have an ongoing place to just present their work and have it available and do it for free. And, you know, always make attendance free, always make presenting free, and just charge for the virtual ticket that people want to, you know, get their stuff in the long run and be able to see everything. So that's what I'm going to do. Because even if you do put something together and you go to a conference, I mean, you've worked for government agencies and stuff like that before. A lot of times you're only funded to go to like one conference, and you've got to pick and choose which one you're going to go to. You can't go to all of them. And, you know, and the one you go to, what was there, 6 people in the room? Maybe, if you're lucky, maybe 20 people if it was like well attended, you know, but even at the SAAs.
What time you're booked at, what slot. If you're at 6 a.m. on a Friday, forget it.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone on the Sunday morning session knows they're speaking to an empty room.
Yeah.
But, oh, you know, God, the ability to present and then record that and then have it available later, then somebody that presented that, even if the room was empty, they would be able to take that information and share the link out and say, here's the presentation I gave. You know, if you want to see this again, go check it out. And we just offer that. And then you can be able to, you know, present in more than one conference throughout the year as well. So
yeah, that's great.
That's the end goal here. I don't know if we'll be able to pull it together, but.
Well, hopefully with that too, even if you have conferences that you attend, I know that you've brought this up in the past too, where it's like all these people present at these conferences, but they're not documented, they're not preserved. No. You can't go back and rewatch someone's presentation unless you were in the audience and you happen to be recording a video on your phone, but there's no platform to be able to record all of those presentations.
No. And it's crazy that it's not being done too. And I don't know why these companies, and they really are corporations like the SAA, the SHA.
Yeah.
I don't know why they don't well, yeah. But I don't know why they don't put more of an emphasis on preservation of these talks. I mean, we're all about preservation of these things, and yet the presentation of this information is not preserved anywhere except in their, they're so proud of their little abstract book. They're like, oh, here's proof that you were at the conference and you did this thing. Like, this is what you can cite. I was like, no, I mean, that, sure, great, thanks for that. But nobody can see my presentation now and all this work I put into it.
Yeah, but if you have, I mean, it's kind of like who owns the data, who owns the information, because if slides where you have maps showing, you know, site sketch maps and locations of where things are located and whatever like that, right? That's pretty much the issue why that needs to be that way.
And that's absolutely true. And you would have to, almost, you know, make it known. And because people could pretty easily alter their presentations to not, show that information. It's not important to the people in the audience to show the coordinates or the exact location of this site. It's really not. Like, I don't care where it's at specifically on this hillside down this road. You can show me that it's in Elko County, Nevada, and I won't know any different, right? I mean, it's just, it's about thinking about your data differently for a wider audience and making sure that, you know, you do strip out that really identifying information, which in the end doesn't really add a lot to the presentation anyway. It's just extra information that most people want to know. Well, what was your hypothesis and what are your conclusions? I mean, that's what we're there for. Yeah. What did you think was going to happen and what actually happened? You know, that's what we want to see. I don't know. Yeah. Now, if you're showing like human remains and things like that, which are appropriate in that kind of setting, but not appropriate to show to the general public on a YouTube channel, then you've got to consider that too. And maybe we have some other stuff that's more locked down, or maybe people can opt out of having their presentation, you know,
or have like a Saturday session, or all like every presentation that's done on Saturday is okay to be broadcasted. But then everything that's on Sunday has sensitive information in it. So therefore you're not going to broadcast. Okay? Maybe if you did something like that.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
I think I'm more excited by the interactive prospects of people being able to ask questions. Because, I mean, right now, when you go to a session, there's people usually are so far behind that there's no time to ask questions or have any real discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why you're back at the bar, right?
Oh, I know.
That's where the network.
Yeah, and this.
Yeah.
This first test conference we're doing, our format was basically 3 hours of conference with a half hour keynote, and then a half hour of questions after that, as needed, but. The 3 hour block before that was basically 3 15-minute presentations that we run concurrently, and then 15 minutes of questions. But that also leaves us 15 minutes to reset for the next hour and get back on schedule. You know, so if we're off by like 5 minutes, maybe we'll only have 10 minutes of questions, and then we can start right back up on the hour after that, because we need to have some sort of clarity like that. Because when we were on the bigger conference, like my co-founder for the APN, he's over in Scotland, and we've got people around the world really that are helping volunteer right now doing different things. So the minute we started thinking about putting on a virtual conference, it had to be a worldwide conference. We had to think about it that way. Yeah. That's why the one we're putting on May 30th starts at 9 o'clock in the morning Pacific time, because that's 4 p.m. GMT in the UK. Mm-hmm. And it's not British summertime, but it's 4 p.m. GMT, I guess. So, but anyway, when we're looking at the bigger one, I mean, ideally, this conference kind of would run. I don't know if the first one would, because I don't think we could pull together the people to do it. But I want to run it in multiple concurrent sessions, multiple languages, and 24 hours a day for about 4 days. That way, your conference is happening in your time zone, in your language, right? So if we have people, an entire session based on, you know, Chinese archaeology, the Chinese archaeologists are presenting that with a Chinese session host so they can understand them. They don't have to present in English. And I mean, they can if they want, but they don't have to. And, you know, they can still have this venue as a place to do that. And that's kind of the idea. So we'd have to run it you know, full on like that, because I'd rather do that than put on like 9 different conferences. You know what I mean? Just do one and then slot people in where they belong, time zone wise and language wise. So
interesting. You know.
Chris, do you think that this is giving us an insight as to how conferences are going to be run in the future?
I hope so.
Do you think once we start doing this, is this going to be something that becomes more common and more?
I hope so, because I think Richie and I were talking about this last night. I think I'm sad that my firm belief that the coronavirus lockdown and the deaths and things are going to continue for the next year. I mean, this Memorial Day weekend is going to go down in history as probably the turning tide for the coronavirus when it got super bad, because we all think it's okay and we're all outside opened up and, you know, beaches. And this is 2 weeks from now, we're going to find out exactly how bad this decision was. And, but even if it's not that bad, just looking at the vectors for this thing, it's going to go into the fall and I think we're going to be all back into lockdown again. So while that's terrible,
when the flu hits as well, it might be
exactly. Yeah. And like I said, well, that's terrible. Obviously, I think 2 months or a spring into summer is not enough time to change human behavior, right?
No.
And as we can see, the states reopened and everybody's trying to go back to normal. We almost need a year of this altered behavior for it to stick, and an entire year of no conferences, an entire year of, you know, people not being able to meet like that to change our behavior on what we think is possible. So I think it's possible, but I don't know.
Well, the thing go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Richie. Yeah, I was going to say, I can see how a lot of people who have gotten to work from home, how people are not going to want to go back to work. And maybe a lot of companies are going to have more people work from home now. And maybe that'll be kind of more common practice. I would be sad if conferences went more online. I think it's good to have that in addition, but you know, I was pretty bummed when my conference got canceled and put off for another year. You know, what are you going to do? But
well, I mean, you know, Chris and I were about to go to the Society for California Archaeology meeting when that whole thing just shut down.
Yeah.
That's the reason they didn't go to the NAAs.
I think just changing the focus of conferences is what really needs to happen. Like we should be presenting our research in a virtual way because it's accessible to more people. It really fits the ethical mandate of, you know, that most societies that you belong to, from RPA to SA or whatever, says, hey, share what you're doing with the general public in the safest way as possible. Like your responsibility as an archaeologist is to educate people and take what you find and share it. And yet we have these lockdown conferences where in a lot of cases, that's the only place somebody ever presented it. You have some grad student or somebody that's doing fantastic work, they agonize for an entire semester on writing a really terrible PowerPoint presentation to give it to 4 people in the room and no one else is ever going to talk about it ever again. What's the point?
Yeah.
Right? So if we had these more frequently and virtual, and then take the physical conferences, acknowledge the reason that we're there, have more networking type activities, have more business building activities, have sessions where CRM company owners and PIs can learn leadership skills and can learn proposal writing skills and stuff like that, and not present research, but go there to network, to have those conversations face to face, to do those kinds of things, and just acknowledge the whole reason we're there to begin with. You know, it's only the real young ones in the field that, and myself included, my first SAA, I had it planned out to the minute which papers I was going to in single
really?
Room.
Yep, you're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and I was running forth and I was finding that I was missing the first 5 minutes of every presentation, or I get to one and they were 3 papers behind and now my whole schedule's off. And it didn't take long for me to not do that anymore. Right.
Yeah. So. I mean, for me, I can count like, God, for the past 5 years, I think I've gone to sat through less than 6 presentations. The rest of the time, I'm just wandering the halls or hanging out where everyone else is hanging out and talking. Yeah.
Not me. I have spent my whole conference career, I guess you could say, going to conferences. Yeah. I feel guilty if I'm late to something or if I miss.
Really?
Yeah, no. The last conference I went to, the NAA conference in Pahrump.
Yeah.
I didn't really go to any of the papers and I felt so guilty. I felt really guilty that I didn't go. You know, because I slept in. Or I went and got lunch, so I skipped a session. And I felt bad about it.
Wow.
Because you have that FOMO, right? You're like, what am I missing out on? I should be at all the papers.
Well, I still remember one conference where I was at, where I sat through someone. It was like a mining. It was a mining symposium. And they were talking about how we should catalog and like do site records on, what was it? Tailings piles. And I'm like, that is the weirdest paper I've ever heard. I can't believe someone presented on this. I don't think I want to sit that's through another paper topic. Again.
Huh? That's a great topic right there.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And then I think the very next paper was, I forget their name, but in order to preserve the site, they completely took apart the stamp mill and then ran out of money. And so they, in order to preserve this site, there was this disassembled stamp mill on a site. And it had been completely intact and like really nice looking. And then so they closed out their paper with like all this lumber just like piled up where the site was. And I'm like, wow, that is... I almost couldn't believe my ears. I'm like, wow, I can't believe I sat through that either.
Wow.
I know.
Yeah.
Or the NAAs where I had to sit through 20 bajillion UNR students talk about, what was it, Danger Cave or something? Like every student presented on the same freaking cave. And so I had to sit through 20 papers on this one site. And I'm like, my God, I wish I weren't stuck at this table, or I wish I didn't sit near the front so I could get up and do something else. I know I sound like a terrible conference goer, but.
Well, you're so, when you're young, you're just so excited and gung-ho about everything. And then the older you get, like, I guess I could say us, I guess I can call us all older. You kind of don't, I mean, you still care, but you realize it's not as important as when you're a grad student or when you're just starting out. You really put in your time and effort and work at conferences, where the older you get, the more it's like, okay, this is kind of a thing I do every year. It's good to see everyone. It kind of changes. Your view changes.
Well, I was going to say some of my best conference memories are all, none of them are about the papers. They're all like about the parties. Like the one SAAs where, I'm not going to say the company, but this company rented a suite and they had a party, a blowout, and they had a bunch of kegs. And it got so rowdy that the hotel kicked them out. And so that's when I met them. They just brought the keg downstairs and we're just like partying downstairs. And I'm like, wow, what happened? I thought you guys had a suite. And they're like, we got kicked out.
Sounds about right.
I know.
Yeah. That's a little extreme there.
Bah. It depends on if you know the company.
Yeah. I'm trying to guess in my mind who I would think that company would be, but. Yeah.
Nice. So is the jewelry store you're working for opening up soon, or are they open already?
They're open already.
They are?
Yeah, they're open right now. I'm currently not back full time yet. It's kind of one of those things where you can be open, but either people are going to come or they're not going to come, you know? So it's kind of that transitional time to see if people are going to come or not. But yeah, right now the work that he would have for me would only be about 2 days worth. So that's not worth kicking someone off unemployment for. But I'm also doing the social media and marketing for the company. So I'm the person that posts to Instagram, Facebook, and all that every day. So I am doing that as well.
Cool.
Ooh, how are you liking it?
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Did you have to do any training or anything? Or you just like, you know, just they just figured, you know, you already use Instagram.
No, not really. We have a really cool light box that hooks up to an app on your phone.
Really?
So you run the light box through your phone and you can like, you know, if you put, say you put the artifact or the piece of jewelry, in the center of the light box on your phone, you can have it do like 45 degrees, 360, slower, faster, whatever. And you hit play on your phone and it'll move it in the light box and you can adjust the light stuff from your phone. So, I've just been taking a lot of photos, and kind of getting back into the photography side of it too.
Ooh. Actually sounds cool.
Yeah, it's fun. It's like all the fun things about archaeology, just apply it to jewelry.
Cool.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh my God. I feel like all of us are starting to do that. I mean, obviously you're making more money than I am with my little videos, but you know, I mean, I find doing all these videos is the fun part of archaeology for me, going places and looking at things. Like the rest of it, the filling out paperwork and all that stuff, I don't care about as much.
Yeah, you got to keep it fresh. You got to do new things. You got to get new hobbies. You got to.
Yeah,
it's healthy to do that for sure.
Or at the very least, get out of get out of like the normal boring field stuff that you don't necessarily like.
Yeah.
I'm looking at your latest Instagram post for BBW Jewelers, and
I see
the light box thing. Yeah, with the ring sitting in like a little thing,
and it like turn. Yeah, it turns.
Yeah.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah, really I've been doing all that stuff for a couple months.
Wow, it's like all the fun part of the lab stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Let's see. Yep.
All right. Well, Richie, I think we should probably kill it for the day. This has been
great. It's been an hour already.
It has. It's pretty close anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And I have a can of beer to open. I've been thinking about.
Well, it's always fun talking with you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm serious about if you get more into this and you have the time, maybe the jewelry store would even have you, they could sponsor it by giving you time to do it. But doing a podcast about this kind of stuff, giving people information like this and bringing in that historical component would be pretty cool. So definitely think about it.
My boss is 100% supportive of what I'm doing, which is fantastic.
Sweet.
So, yeah,
that's absolutely. Good to have.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
We don't, that's another thing we'd always get in our archaeology.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
So some bosses are, but not all of them.
Not all of them.
That's right.
Well, thank you for having me on today and letting me talk about, what I'm doing with jewelry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always good. I feel like it's always good for people out there to see that, you don't have to stick with the field archaeology if it doesn't interest you as a job, you want to do something else.
Yeah. And real quick, I just want to reiterate.
Yeah.
It's okay to do something else. You don't have to feel guilty about it. I had a huge identity crisis and thought, who am I without archaeology? It's all I've ever done.
Yeah.
And just because you're doing something else and you're adding on to what you've already done in life doesn't detract from what you've already done with archaeology. So it doesn't make you less of an archaeologist if you're currently not employed at a CRM company. You don't lose that. Like your master's degree or whatever doesn't get taken away because you're doing something else. So I just want to say that it's okay to do something else.
Yeah.
And I just want to reiterate that this time around. Because I definitely have a lot of guilt about it, you know?
Yeah. And, it's like, it's different. I feel like what you mentioned is different than some other people, because when I worked at the bookstore, we had a whole bunch of people with master's degrees and PhDs who, felt like they were stuck at the bookstore, you know. Mm-hmm. But, what you're talking about is completely different, doing something that matches your interest and skills more than being in the field.
Yeah. And you could try it out. You could always go back to archaeology. That's one good thing about it. There's always going to be jobs. You're always going to be able to go back to it.
Yeah.
So, try something new,
Yeah. I mean, especially if, you don't mind ticks or all the snakes.
Yeah.
Or all the terrible motel rooms.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely dress up a lot more in my current job than I ever had in archaeology.
Oh, my God. I noticed that when I was working at the bookstore, too.
Yep.
I was actually using clothes I hadn't seen in years.
Yeah. Same. All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. And I'll just tell anybody that's listening to the recording of this on the Archaeology Podcast Network, there's a number of links that we've dropped into the chat over here on the Archaeology Podcast Network Facebook page. Just look for our videos tab and you call this Archaeology episode 85. And you can find those links over there. Because I'm not sure I'm going to get all these into the show notes of the audio
version.
So, well, I might. We'll see. Depends on how much time I have. So.
Episode 85.
Yeah.
Awesome. Episode 85. Thank you.
There you go. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Jenny. And
thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun.
This is fun. Yeah.
All right.
Oh, and before we go, we should say hello to Amy. She watches every week.
Hi, Amy.
Hey, there you go. Hi, Amy. Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.